Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
A very good afternoon. Welcome along to the show. I'm Justin Briley with you for Unbelievable, the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate. Looking forward to today's discussion. It's a deep dive, a philosophical one today. So hold on to your hats. Apologetics nerds are going to love today's debate on the cosmological argument and a bit of a new twist on an old argument. I'll be introducing my guests very shortly. If you want more from Unbelievable, go to the show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can get the pre-order now of our DVD of this year's Unbelievable Conference in London. Took place about a month ago. Also available via digital download. So do check out the links for that from the show page. It's available from the Premier shop. Also excited to say that The Big Conversation returns for season two from September onwards. We've got debates going on with people like William Lane Craig and Roger Penrose. You'll be hearing the live UK debate that took place between Alistair McGrath and Brett Weinstein. Sat down to record a fabulous discussion between Bart Ehrman and Peter J. Williams that's going to be part of that, and some more shows lining up soon as well. Of course, one of those is going to be live in LA. We're going to be out there on Friday, the 11th of October. My guests are going to be John Lennox and Dave Rubin for that conversation on Is God Dead? Faith, Culture and the Modern World, followed by Unbelievable, the Conference LA on Saturday, the 12th of October, all happening at Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa. We're going to be learning from speakers who have journeyed from atheism to Christianity at the conference on Saturday. People who now make the case for why science, history, philosophy and experience all point to the one who changes the mind, heart and soul, Jesus Christ. And that's why the theme of this year's conference is Change My Mind. Go and check out all the speakers. John Lennox staying on for that. I'm sure we'll do a bit of a debrief on the night before as well. But loads of other people joining us for this year's conference out in LA. You can come along to both those events for a special price, or you can just choose to go to one or the other. The place to book your ticket is unbelievable.live. And my own book will be available along with lots of other resources at the conference. Happy to sign as many copies as people want to buy as well. Again, the website is unbelievable.live. We're going to find some time later on in the programme for some of your feedback. Right now, it's time to get into today's discussion.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today we're asking, is God the cause of the universe? And this is a classic one, isn't it? A ground we've trod many times, I would say, on Unbelievable in one form or another. Cosmological arguments are among the most popular arguments for theism today in apologetics, especially in light of the evidence for the universe coming into existence with the Big Bang. And someone who's developed some of those most popular arguments for God as a cause of the universe joins me today in studio. Andrew Loke is Assistant Professor of Philosophy and Religion at Hong Kong Baptist University. He's the author of God and Ultimate Origins, in which he argues the philosophical case for God as the best explanation of the cause of the universe. And today, Andrew will be in conversation with atheist philosopher Alex Malpas from Bristol, who blogs at the Use of Reason website, also runs the Thoughtology podcast. So today we're asking, is there good reason to believe that the universe began to exist, firstly? And if that's true, does everything that begins to exist have a cause? And, well, if that's true, is God the best explanation of the cause of the universe? Looking forward to today's show. Alex and Andrew, welcome along to the programme. Great to have you with me. We'll start with you first of all, Andrew. Never been on the show before, but I know that we've been in touch a little bit over the years. Yes. Because obviously so much of your work in this area coincides with some of the debates we've had on Unbelievable over the years. Mm-hmm. But tell us how things began for you and how you ended up doing what you do at Hong Kong Baptist University.
Hi, Justin. It's a delight to be here to talk to you. So for me, I have been thinking about the questions of ultimate origins since I was very young, wanting to find out to get to the bottom of things, kind of. And when I was in medical school, I had a friend who was an atheist, and he would ask me challenging questions about why I think that the universe is created by God, right? And so that got me interested in the cosmological argument to try to find an answer to his questions. Mm-hmm. And over the years, I had the privilege of getting into a email discussion with Graham Oppy, who is one of the top atheist philosophers working on these issues. And we had a 120 email exchange on the cosmological argument.
120 email exchange.
Yeah, that's right. 60 from him and 60 from me, around there. And so at the end of this email discussion, I came to realize that the cosmological argument is still defensible. Mm-hmm. And I work out my response to his objections, and eventually it became this book, God and Ultimate Origins.
So when you began that email exchange with Graham Oppy, were you thinking along the lines of this being published, or was it informal to begin with and then it became formalized later? How did it work?
Yeah, I wasn't thinking that it would become a book, actually.
Yeah.
I was just trying to show Graham that, you know, that there's a plausible case to mm-hmm. be made, and wondering what are his objections. And
to yeah. what extent have you followed the lead of well-known philosophers like William Lane Craig, who have obviously developed the Kalam cosmological argument? Are you building yeah. on that kind of work, essentially?
Yes, indeed. In fact, Craig answered many of my questions when I was wrestling with these issues. Mm. And Craig was my professor at Biola University, where I did my master's in philosophy.
So very influential then. Yeah,
yes, sure. Great influence on me, yeah.
To what extent would you say you've taken that then and sort of developed your own particular ways of looking at these big questions?
Yeah, so when I was in this discussion with Graham, I came to realize that some of Craig's arguments can be further refined to address the objections that Graham Oppy raises. And so the refinements are documented in the book that I publish.
Do you find that this is a powerful argument, in your view, for persuading people of of evidence for God? I mean, to what extent have you seen this argument actually make a difference, I suppose, in whether people are actually open to the evidence for God in the end?
I think this argument is very powerful, actually. Mm-hmm. At the very least, it helps people to see that, well, it's rational to believe in God. Mm-hmm. But I think the argument is even more powerful than that. I think it can be demonstrated with a kind of a logical certainty that there must be a kind of divine first cause.
Great to have you on the program today, Andrew. Really pleased that we could make this happen while you're over in the UK briefly. You've been at a conference just recently, I know, talking about these ideas Cambridge?
At the Oxford Centre for Science and Religions conference, annual
great.
Conference. Yeah.
Great. Well, yeah. We're looking forward to at least getting the digestible version of that on today's show. I'm sure you went into much greater to depth at the conference. Great to have on the line also joining us Alex Malpass. Alex, welcome on to the show. Your first time also. What got you into engaging with, well, firstly philosophy generally, but specifically your interest in engaging with the kinds of arguments that people like Andrew bring in terms of Christian theism? How did it begin for you, Alex?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that I've always been kind of philosophically inclined mm-hmm. from an early age, as far back as I can remember thinking about things. I've enjoyed thinking about these types of topics. So philosophy was a natural subject for me to go into. And I was, I guess I wasn't inclined from an early age to get a sensible degree, like law or medicine or something like that. So I indulged
something actually,
my curiosity.
Yeah, why go for anything practical when you can just sit in an armchair and think about the universe, eh?
That's right, yeah. So then I did that and I got a PhD and I was had a couple of teaching posts after that. And I think I sort of fell out of love with philosophy briefly. And I think it was partly because it wasn't quite as fun when I think I got to a point where the thing I was specializing was incredibly technical and I sort of fell out of love with it. Mm. So I decided to change careers and just do different things and see what the rest of the world was like apart from the philosophy department. But then I think after giving up philosophy for a while, through things like your show, actually, I came back to re-engage with philosophy outside of the kind of extreme academic technical circles and started engaging with things again that were interesting to a different part of my brain, let's say. So it's another area that's fun to play. The way I approach this is, it's a fun area to think about. It's interesting to me. It's a hobby. It's what I like doing. Mm. So I don't take it quite as seriously as thinking that I will prove something with complete concrete certainty. But I do enjoy thinking about them, playing around with the kind of abstract.
What I've appreciated in reading some of the posts on your Use of Reason website is that you're willing to critique your fellow atheist philosophers as much as the Christians and so on. And so I think you get flack from both sides probably in terms of being willing to do that. I mean, for you, has sort of atheism been the kind of, you know, the position you've taken kind of naturally for a long time? Has there been any rethinking of that at any level as you've gone along in your, you know, thinking through these issues?
There's thinking about it, of course. All philosophy of religion is thinking about that question. So I've done a lot of thinking about it. I suppose you're asking whether I've been inclined to change my mind, and I'm not sure that I have. I think, so for me, atheism has never really been much of a decision that I took at any point. I just found myself an atheist without any... my parents are not religious. My dad used to be, but isn't anymore. I don't know if that made an effect on me. It's hard to say. But I grew up with a religious understanding. He taught us a bit from the Bible, so I have a general understanding as a child. But I've never been drawn towards believing. I've just always been an atheist. And the more I've studied philosophy, religion, I haven't seen anything that's made a particularly big impact in terms of persuading me to change my mind. So I suppose I've got a prior probability, you could put it like that, of theism being quite low, and I haven't seen anything that's made me overcome that.
Well, look, it's great to have you on the line today to engage with Andrew on this particular issue, which I'm sure you're familiar with and have heard many a debate on before. But I'll be interested to see the specific ways in which we're going to try and cash it out today, because this book you've written, Andrew, is a big one. God and Ultimate Origins, tackling the cosmological argument from a number of different perspectives, and why a first cause makes sense in your view philosophically. But we're going to sort of narrow down on some specifics just for the sake of today's argument, so because we can't cover too much ground. If you're wanting to get in touch yourself about today's show, don't forget you can get in touch via our email address, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. There's also the social media, @unbelievablejb for Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievablejb, and those are available from the webpage as well, where you can find today's show, subscribe to the podcast and share it with others too. Recording for video today as well, so do check out the video version of today's program over at the Unbelievable YouTube channel. All of the links available from the show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
I've promised the listening audience that we'll try and keep this, even though it's a deep dive today, that we won't get too out of our depth, let's say, Andrew. I know that you're going to do your level best to keep it accessible. Do you want to just spell out briefly, you know, what at its simplest level this argument is, and how you then start to develop that in a few ways to kind of strengthen that and tease that out a bit more?
Sure. So in a nutshell, the cosmological argument tries to show that an infinite regress of causes is impossible, and therefore there must be a first cause. And this first cause must be uncaused, because it's a first, and it must also be without beginning, because everything that begins to exist has a cause. And it must also be initially changeless, because there can't be because there cannot be an infinite regress of changes. And the first change, that is the first event, could not have begun to exist uncaused. And so the first event must have been caused by an initially changeless first cause.
Okay.
And for this initially changeless first cause to cause the first event, the first cause must have the capacity to initiate the first event, to initiate the first change in a way that is not determined by prior events. And it must also have the capacity to be able to prevent itself from changing initially, and such that it can be initially changeless. And so these two capacities, you know, having the capacity to initiate the first event and also to be able to prevent itself from initiating the first event, this dual capacity characterizes libertarian free will. And so this first cause must have free will in order to freely bring about the first event from an initial changeless state. And finally, this first course must also have tremendous power to bring about the rest of other things, right, including the universe.
The universe, sure. Yeah.
And so what we have here is a first course that is uncaused, without beginning, has free will and tremendous power. And I think that deserves to be called a creator. Mm-hmm. And therefore, there's good reasons to believe that a creator of the universe exists.
That is it in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. And we're obviously going to tease that out. Obviously, where does this connect, in your view, with Big Bang cosmology? Because that's obviously the thing people often think of when they think of the universe beginning to exist and so on. Do you tend to, you know, trace more of a philosophical argument than a scientific argument for the idea that the universe has a cause, has a beginning in that sense?
I think both the philosophical argument and the scientific arguments are pretty powerful. Mm-hmm. But I think the philosophical argument is even more powerful because it can be demonstrated with a kind of deductive certainty, actually. Now, having said that, I need to clarify that I'm not saying that in order for a good an argument to be a good argument, it has to be deductively certain. I'm not saying that. Mm-hmm. I think as long as you have better reasons to believe that it's true rather than it's false, I think that'll be sufficient. But however, I myself do think that the philosophical version is actually pretty powerful, in fact, more powerful than the scientific version.
Okay, so just tease out a little bit again then the philosophical version of this. You've already mentioned this idea that you can't have an infinite regress of causes, okay? So we're all familiar with the idea that everything around us sort of has a cause for why things are happening. And that if you traced back the history of us and the universe, you would find cause upon cause upon cause leading to us. And it leads you to that question of, well, is there a point at which we have an end to that, you know, or could things simply stretch back into the eternal past, if you like, and there be an infinite regress of causes? And for you, that doesn't make sense philosophically. There has to be something that, if you like, starts the whole thing off, and that itself cannot be caused in that sense, an uncaused cause,
yes.
A first cause. These are the kind of philosophical terms that were created, but especially by, you know, Leibniz and Anselm and others who developed these arguments. So are you essentially kind of taking that idea that's been around for a long time and saying, okay, this is my version of it, if you like?
So in the history of philosophy, there has been a number of arguments which has been offered, right, to show that the infinite regress is not possible.
Mm-hmm.
William Lane Craig defended two versions. One is the argument for the impossibility of concrete infinities. And he used the Hilbert Hotel, for example, you know, to illustrate the kind of absurdities which will exist, right, if a concrete actual infinite exists in reality.
Yes, so the idea of an actually infinite set of events is philosophically incoherent, essentially, is the idea. Because you can show that by using examples of impossible things that would happen if you had an infinite number of events in the past, yeah.
Yes, so that's the first argument.
Right.
And the second argument is the argument for the impossibility of traversing an actual infinite, which means that the number of events following one after another cannot arrive at an actual infinity. And so the number of earlier events must be finite,
yeah.
And there must be a first cause.
In a sense, we couldn't get to now if there was an infinite chain of events up to now, because you would never arrive at now if it was actually infinite in that sense.
Yeah, to put it simply.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of slightly brain-boggling stuff, but I like it. There's a sort of sense in which I think most people can intuitively grasp that idea that things can't have gone on forever in the past or we wouldn't get to now. Therefore, things must have begun finitely at some point. And then it obviously opens up that question, well, was there a beginning source of that? And your view is obviously this idea that it appears to have the characteristics, as far as you can tell, of God, that it would have to cause the universe to come into existence. And itself would have to have the ability to choose to do that. It wouldn't be something that somehow it had to do. It was something that's chosen. And for you, this libertarian free will is an important aspect of the nature of a being that we would describe as God, essentially.
Yes.
Great. I think we're there. But anything to add to it before we...
Sure, yeah. So in my book, I added one more argument.
Hmm.
And this is an argument for the lack of capacity to begin to exist.
The capacity to begin to exist. Okay, yeah. Tell us what that is.
So, okay, let me illustrate using a simple analogy. Right? Suppose I have nothing, and the only way for me to begin to have money is to get it from you, Justin.
Okay.
Right? Now, suppose that you also have nothing, and the only way for you to begin to have money is to get it from Alex, for example.
Okay.
Now, if Alex is also in a similar situation, if everyone is like this, right, then there's no way that any one of us will ever begin to have money. Right.
Right.
So what is required is for there to be someone who doesn't need to get money from any other person, but who is able to invent money or somehow who have come up with money, right, mm-hmm. in order to start the whole chain going.
Okay.
So likewise, now I have no existence before I begin to exist, right? And so before I begin to exist, my parents have to begin to exist.
Mm-hmm.
And before they begin to exist, their parents have to begin to exist, mm-hmm. etc. Now, if everyone and everything is like this, right, then nothing would begin to exist. So what is required is there must be a first cause, which does not need to depend on another thing to bring it into existence. And such a thing would then must also have the capacity to bring other things into existence. And such a first cause would have to be without beginning, because everything that begins to exist requires a cause.
Right.
And so this is an argument to show that there must be a beginningless first cause.
I mean, it sounds similar in a way to the Leibnizian argument of God being a necessary being in that sense, while everything else appears, as far as we can see, to be contingent, to have a cause for its existence, didn't have to be here in that sense. Is that an analogy? But there's probably some differences, I imagine, between those.
Yeah, there's some similarities in that the argument demonstrates a necessary being, but there's also a difference as well. Because in the Leibnizian version, Leibniz does not prove that the first cause... the Leibnizian version doesn't concern the beginning of existence. It relies on the principle of sufficient reason. Whereas the version that I'm defending here is based on the causal principle, which is everything that begins to exist has a cause, and demonstrating that there must be a beginningless first cause, and which must also have free will, right, to begin the first event. And so the history of events must have a beginning, and that shows that... and that's the difference, right, between my version and the Leibnizian version.
Yeah. So... Great. This is really helpful. And we just needed a bit of time there, I think, Alex, to spell this out, this particular
sure.
Way of thinking about the argument. So it's really up to you, Alex, where you want to begin. We've got about, 5 minutes this side of the first break for you to start to open up some of your questions and objections to this. So where do you want to begin, Alex?
Well, I think I can say something briefly about most of those things that have come up, but we can go in more depth, I think, organically as it comes up, because maybe something I'll say will sound more objectionable than something else. So I think let's start at the beginning. So we have a couple of philosophical reasons. I mean, let's just, to some extent, let's put the physics to one side. I mean, I think physics is hard. Neither of us are physicists, and physics is in a weird state of change, and it's a very tentative area. I would be hesitant to draw much that I would rely on. I wouldn't bet my house on a cosmological theory, contemporary cosmological theory, because they're all kind of speculative and there's no particular agreement amongst cosmologists about exactly which theory is the best one. So they point towards there being a big bang, very hot, very dense stage of the universe about 13 billion years ago, whatever. But there's serious disagreement about what the status of, like, immediately prior to that was,
sure.
whether that's the beginning or whether there's some other stuff going on. There's lots of different interesting models. So I just want to put that to one side, because it feels to me it's just a big mess and it's hard to know what to think about it.
Well, we've got a very, very interesting show on that coming up in our next season of The Big Conversation, when William Lane Craig and Roger Penrose sat down to debate some of those issues. So, we'll leave that one aside for them to debate at another time. But go ahead. Let's stick with the philosophy this time then. So go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, okay. So there's, on the one hand, there's an argument which says something about there must be a beginning, right? There must be a first event. Otherwise, there would be an endless series of events in the past. And there can't be an endless series of anything, because that would be an actual infinity, which is a kind of technical term. What that term means in set theory, which is where it comes from, is that it's a quantity where you can take a proper part of that quantity and line it up with the whole, right? So you can show mathematically that there are just as many even numbers as there are whole numbers. And intuitively you think, well, it's got to be half as many, right? But you can show mathematically that there's the same number, right? So infinite sets have that property. And it's a weird property, definitely. It's counterintuitive. And if there was an infinite series of events in the past, then you could kind of number them and line up every other one with the total. And you'd be able to sort of show that it had the same property. And the thought would be, well, while you can imagine things like that in set theory or whatever, there would be, those types of consequences. So Hilbert's hotel is the example. It's got infinite guests in there. But you can, even if every room is full, you can accommodate new guests by just getting everyone to move up one room.
Yeah.
Each guest has one room to go into, and it makes a new room for somebody else to come along. So it was full, but there's still room for someone else, right? So you have these kind of weird consequences. And I agree, that's weird, right? But I guess I get off the train at that point because I just kind of think it's weird, but weirdness itself, or as it's put, absurdity, shouldn't put you off of the philosophical argument, or else you're not going to get very far. And, you know, there's weird stuff that we think is true, like superpositions or whatever. Like if I gave you an a priori argument for a superposition 150 years ago, you'd probably tell me that it was absurd and too weird to contemplate. Now we all think it's true. So I don't know whether it being weird is a good reason to think that it couldn't exist. And lots of the arguments turn on, it seems to me, some way of... and I think it's important just to put a flag down in this, some way of reconciling our... You know, we're expecting things to be like we see them around us. But if that thing was true, things would be different from how they seem to be around us. And that's the reason to think that
it couldn't be. So are you essentially at the outset questioning the idea that you couldn't necessarily have an actually infinite set of events? You're saying, okay, yes, when we use things like Hilbert's hotel, it seems to have absurd consequences to us. Commonsensically, it doesn't seem to make sense. But... we know that weird stuff happens in reality, and therefore we shouldn't necessarily grant this first premise of the argument that you can't have an infinite set of events. So I think that's a good question to ask right at the outset. And since we're already heading into our first break, let's take a quick pause and then have Andrew respond to it, and we'll do some more and see where we get to in the rest of the conversation. Deep dive today, something we come back to every so often. I think about a year ago, actually, we last did the Kalam cosmological argument. I think that was Alex O'Connor, the cosmic skeptic, on that occasion, taking the atheist role opposite, let me see, who was it? Oh, I can't remember. It was probably Cameron Bertuzzi or someone like that. Do go and check out the past archive of Unbelievable for more debates in this area, something we come back to every so often. My guest today, Andrew Loke, Assistant Professor of Philosophy and Religion at Hong Kong Baptist University, defending the idea that God is the best explanation of the cause of the universe. Alex Malpass, atheist philosopher from Bristol, who's taking the skeptical line on that one. And we are going to be back in a short moment's time with more from the show that aims to get you thinking Unbelievable.
Hello and welcome to the program that brings Christians and non-Christians together with me, Justin Brierley. For over 10 years, as host of Unbelievable, I've listened to objections to faith from the world's leading skeptics. And the most common question I get is, how come you still believe? Unbelievable, the book, is my answer. Telling the story of the show and drawing on hundreds of conversations with atheists and Christians, I explain why I still believe Jesus is the answer to life's deepest questions. Get your copy of Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, at unbelievablebook.co.uk.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to this week's edition of the show, doing a philosophical deep dive on whether God is the cause of the universe, a common question we circle around to fairly frequently here on Unbelievable. Cosmological arguments are probably among the most popular apologetic arguments. Kind of easy to grasp, aren't they, intuitively? You know, if the universe came into existence, what caused the universe? Could that cause be God? Well, Andrew Loke, Assistant Professor of Philosophy and Religion at Hong Kong Baptist University, who's passing through London, has managed to come to my studio to talk about his own way of approaching this. He's the author of God and Ultimate Origins. I'll make sure there are links to that from today's program. In conversation today with Alex Malpass, who's an atheist philosopher from Bristol, and he runs the Thoughtology podcast and the Use of Reason website. And just in that last section, Andrew, Alex saying, okay, it's weird to us, the idea of an actually infinite set of events in the past, but hey, weird things happen. Maybe we just aren't in a position to kind of, you know, rule it out necessarily. So how do you respond to that yourself?
Well, before I respond to that, let me first clarify that there are a number of arguments to show that an infinite regress is not possible.
Mm-hmm.
And this argument that Alex's objections is concerned with is only one of the arguments, right? The Hilbert Hotel type of arguments is only one of the arguments.
Sure.
I want to emphasize that each of these arguments, and in fact, there are others. So, for example, there's still one more argument offered by this philosopher called Ben Waters. It's called Methuselah diary, you know, which tries to show that there's some kind of paradox which will result, right, if there's an infinite past.
I don't know if you could very briefly explain that, because it sounds fascinating just from the name, the Methuselah Diary.
Methuselah Diary, yeah.
Okay, can you explain what that kind of particular objection to infinities is?
It may take some time to explain.
Okay, but maybe we'll leave it. Probably opening a can of worms I shouldn't then.
But, but my point is simply that, you know, any one of these arguments will be, if sound, will be sufficient to demonstrate the conclusion.
Right? Okay.
And so the defender of the kalam does not have to defend all four arguments. He just has to defend one of them.
Okay.
And for me personally, I think that all four of them are defensible. Mm-hmm. But to defend all of them, I think will take too much time.
Okay.
We don't have time. But for the Hubert Hotel type of argument, you can check out my book, mm-hmm. God and Ultimate Origins, in chapter 2. I explain that... And the problem with the concrete actual infinite is not just that there will be some kind of weird results, as Alex says, but that it will actually violate certain necessary truths. Mm-hmm. If that and therefore such a concrete actual infinite cannot exist. Right?
So is it the equivalent of saying, like, if we accept something like, you know, the law of non-contradiction, you know, that A and not A cannot both be the case, you can't simply say, oh, well, weird things happen, so maybe that could be the case. We've got to just accept that some things can't be on the basis of logic, and this is one of them, as far as you're concerned.
Yeah, so logical impossibility will be one kind of metaphysical impossibility, mm-hmm. right? But there are other kinds as well, which I explain in my book.
Yeah.
But for today's discussion, I don't want to go there because it will take a long time.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
So I would like to focus on the new argument which I developed, the argument for the lack of capacity to begin to exist.
Well, let's just get a quick response from Alex before we go there. And we do want to obviously focus on your specific argument. But Alex, you know, obviously Andrew feels it is defensible, and you can't simply say, well, you know, maybe weird things happen. As far as Andrew's concerned, it's an impossibility that we're dealing with here.
Yeah, obviously I agree there's more to be said than that, I do have a feeling that a lot of the arguments trade around similar issues, although there are different ways of stating the argument. And my gut feeling is that most of them trade on that type of reaction I was sketching out very briefly there, which I totally concede is massively inefficient to really, massively insufficient to deal with the arguments on their own. I do want to just very, very briefly just say something about logical impossibility is a matter of basically deriving a contradiction from a set of claims. Fair enough. I could say a lot about that, but I won't. But very quickly, the idea that there's some other type of possibility that's called metaphysical possibility, I am very dubious about this. I just don't know what we're talking about there very often, especially if they're very removed from our experience. You know, I'm perfectly clear that it's, let's say, metaphysically possible for me to have a conversation with you guys, because that's happening right now, and I guess everything that's actual is possible. But once we start straying very far away from our experiences, I wonder the basis that we can really claim to know metaphysical possibility, especially if it's not just reducible to logical possibility. There's some other grade of possibility there. So I'm very dubious of claims like that are very far away from our experience. But I'll have to shut up.
Yeah, but no, we obviously, that because of time, we will move things along and let you develop a bit more of your own argument here now, Andrew. How do you want to move on, you know, in terms of this idea of, you know, in your view, you can't get this infinite regress, so you have to sort of have a backstop, if you like. Carry on the argument and let's see what Alex has to say.
Yeah, so let me say something about metaphysical impossibility first. I understand the reasons why Alex has some doubts about this notion. And I think to address this doubt, we have to look into the details of the argument, actually. I try to explain in chapter 2 of my book, why is it metaphysically impossible that concrete infinities exist? But I don't want to go further in that direction because I want to focus on the new argument, which I presented very briefly just now, which is that the argument for the lack of capacity to begin to, begin to exist.
So the lack of capacity to begin to exist for you is a significant strengthening, if you like, argument on the cosmological argument. So spell it out for us again briefly and let's dive into it.
Yeah, and the reason why this new argument is a significant addition to the other existing arguments is because this argument does not need to get into complicated debates about the nature of infinities, right? Which some people might have some doubts about, but which I think those doubts can be addressed. Actually, I think the argument is still defensible, but my new argument doesn't need to go
okay.
that direction.
So you can kind of put that to one side.
Yeah,
and,
that's right.
And still have a very strong argument here in your view.
Yes,
go
that's
ahead.
Right. Yeah, and so the argument in a nutshell is I try to illustrate the analogy just now that. If everything that begins to exist requires a prior thing, which itself also requires something to bring it into existence, then nothing would begin to exist. So yeah. There needs to be a first entity.
Like with the analogy about the money.
If
you need money and you want me to give it to you, but I need money, someone else to give it to me, Alex, and he needs someone to... none of us are capable of producing the money ourselves. Mm-hmm. We have to have an original source that can produce money. And the same applies to the cause of existence, if you like, the cause of the universe and everything we know. So you call this the lack of capacity to begin to exist, and this is something, in your view, only God can have, this lack of capacity to begin to exist?
Well, the argument is actually based on the causal principle that everything begins to exist requires a cause.
Yes.
Right? For me to begin to exist, my parents have to begin to exist first before I can begin to exist. Mm-hmm. Right? And for them to begin to exist, their parents have to begin to exist first before they can begin to exist. And so if that is all there is, then nothing would just begin to exist. Just as if each of us have no money on our own and we need other people to give us money, then none of us will ever begin to have money. Mm-hmm. Right? So what is required is a first entity. Right? In the case of the causal regress, there must be a first cause to terminate the regress. Mm-hmm. And the first cause must have independent existence.
Right.
Right. Independent existence in the sense that it does not require another thing to bring it into existence. Mm-hmm. Right. And in order for the first cause to have this independent existence, it must be beginningless because everything that begins to exist requires a cause. Mm-hmm. So if the causal premise is true, then I think the conclusion follows.
Right. Okay. Well, let's go with that before we start to dig any further. Alex, what do you make of this particular way of expressing the argument?
Yeah. So, thanks. I think it's helpful. I'm wondering why I missed the bit, I guess, where we excluded the possibility that there's an infinite chain of people, say, lending each other money. How did we rule that out?
An infinite chain of people lending each other money. So are you saying that you don't necessarily have to have someone starting that chain off? It could just an infinite...
For me to exist, my parents needed to have existed first, and for them to exist, and blah blah blah. But what I'm not catching the contradiction with the hypothesis that we don't think this is actually true, but logically, just think about a situation where everybody has parents, and the chain just goes on without any beginning. Like, what's the objection in this argument to that hypothesis? How did we rule that out?
Go ahead, Andrew.
Okay, so the objection to that will be similar to the objection say everybody who can begin to exist can begin to have money would require another person to give it to him before he can have money. And in that case, but the problem is that nobody has money to begin with. It's like saying that each person has someone to give them money, but the problem is that each person has no money, right? And so there's no capacity for anybody to have money. And likewise, there's no capacity for anything to begin to exist if that's the case.
But if everybody borrows money from somebody, right, and then it feels like that first premise is satisfied, right, that no one has the capacity to make their own money or something. Everybody borrows money off somebody else.
But so somebody else also has no money.
True. Yeah. Sorry, I missed that.
So, but Andrew's saying, but the problem is that the somebody else in question doesn't have any money either. They're going to be borrowing it, but the chain goes on. No one in this causal regress,
no one in this chain has
ever actually has any money. They're waiting for the person who eventually can give the money, and that person never comes in an infinite regress of people.
Okay, I suppose
money.
The way I'm seeing this is that there's this premise which says that nobody can generate their own money, right? Let's assume that premise is true, it feels like you want to say, well, it follows from that that nobody's got any money. And I want to say, well, if you could borrow money off someone that had money, then you'd have money. And I think you agree with that. If somebody borrows money off someone who has money, then they can have money. And it feels like the first premise is going to be true. still, right, just the fact that you can't make your own money, that's going to be true, but you can still have money as long as everybody's borrowed money off somebody else. And I'm not seeing that there's a logical contradiction with the hypothesis that there's just an infinite chain of people who've borrowed money off the previous person. And now you can say, well, where did the money come from? Right. But I'd be careful about saying that in a way that doesn't beg the question. Right. Because you can't say, well, who had the first money? Because on this hypothesis, there is no first money. Right. There's just an infinite regress that just goes back forever. So there is no first. So it would be question begging to say, where did the first bit of money come from? But my question is just where's the contradiction? I mean, if there's no contradiction, it just feels like there is a consistent way of making the premise that you can't make your own money, or you can't be a train that pulls itself without a car that's already moving, pulling it, or there can't be a cause, an effect that doesn't have a cause. You know, all of these arguments are basically the same way of saying, different ways of saying the same thing. But it just feels like I want a reason to rule out conceptually the idea that there's just a chain that goes back forever. I'm still not quite getting it.
Yeah, so the reason that rules out is that 0 plus 0 plus 0 is still equal to 0, right? So where the money comes from, right? So I'm not begging the question by assuming that there's a first guy who has money, but I'm saying that nobody has money, right? And just like also in the analogy of the train, you mentioned that just now, and I mentioned in my book as well, you know, suppose there's a series of train cars, wagons, right? Mm-hmm. So before the last wagon can begin to move, the wagon before it has to begin to move.
Yes.
And before that, the wagon before that has to begin to move, the one before that has to begin to move.
Yes.
Right? If that's the case, then no matter how many wagons you have, right, none of them will begin to move. what you need is a engine, right? A first mover, kind of, something that can begin to move by itself and doesn't require another thing to pull it along for that to exist and begin to move, and then the rest will begin to move. That's why it's required.
Okay. But your problem here, Alex, seems to be you're satisfied that you could, in principle, have an endless course of things that are moving, or where money is being handed along, or things are being caused, even if you never reached a first cause or an engine or someone with some money, you could still have an endless chain of those things happening. And obviously, Andrew just fundamentally disagrees that you can't have that to start with without a first cause.
Right. So, first of all, I don't know, right? I'm not saying I believe that there's an endless cause of an endless chain of causes. I don't know if there is or not, right? That's not my position. But if Andrew wants to say that, you know, such and such argument, therefore there has to be a first cause, there needs to be something that's prevented this otherwise possible, at least conceptually, option that there isn't a first cause, but, you know, everything is just caused by something else. So let's go back to the train analogy, because the idea of the 0 plus 0 plus 0 whatever equals 0, that comes from the book, and it's part of the book that I read prior to this. So, and I had some thoughts about it. So obviously it's true, if you have a chain of train cars that's not moving, right, for them to start moving, and let's say they can't generate their own motion, right, they have to be pulled in order to move, then they're not going to start moving unless there's one that can generate its first motion, a first puller, as Andrew describes it in the book. That's true. So I think if you have a bunch of stationary cars that can't start moving unless as a first puller, then they're not going to start moving unless there's a first puller. I think that's a sort of plain and straightforward, and I agree with that. That's right. But I don't, you know, I want to say, well, why can't there be an infinite series of train cars, each of which can't move unless it's being pulled by one that's moving, which is moving, right? And then each one is pulling the next one, right? And so each one, the sort of explanation for its movement is to be found in the one that's pulling it, right? And that explanation just goes all the way down the line. And so to put, you know, Andrew's mathematical expression of that was 0 plus 0 plus 0 equals 0. And I kind of want to say, you know, 1 times 1 times 1 is 1, right? As long as they're all moving, then the movement of the whole thing will be the same speed as any of them in particular. So, you know, if we start off saying that they're not moving, are they going to start moving? No, they're not. But what about if they were already moving? Then there wouldn't be any need for a first mover, that seems to me.
Yeah, okay. So I address this objection in my book as well. You know, and my response to this is that if you assume that the cars are already moving, right, then that would be disanalogous to the situation we have here, which is, you know, things begin to exist requires a cause, right? Because if they're already moving, then they don't begin to move, right? They're already moving, right? But whereas the situation here is that, you know, things do begin to exist, and they can't begin to exist on, by their own power, and so they require something else to begin to exist first. And so, yeah, so I think your objection, the kind of alternative scenario that you mentioned will be this analogous, right, to my argument, and therefore doesn't constitute a relevant objection to my arguments.
Okay, good. So I think I want to say two things. So let's see if I can keep them straight in my head. So I think the first thing to say is that saying that the causal chain, so saying that the kind of train car series where they're all moving is disanalogous, I find that claim quite puzzling, because to me it seems quite so. Let's just be clear about it. The infinite series of train cars that are all moving seems quite analogous to me to an infinite series of causes, each of which is an infinite series of effects, let's say, where each one is caused by the previous effect. It just feels very similar. I'm not sure why it's disanalogous. And if the point of disanalogy is that there's no beginning to the movement, then that feels like, well, it would be saying that it's disanalogous only that it doesn't have a beginning in it. But then, you know, my whole point here is that we're not considering a chain that doesn't have a beginning. I'm not sure why it's unfair to talk about a chain that doesn't have a beginning in that context. So I'm not really getting why it's disanalogous.
So the disanalogy is in the each of the individual members of the chain, right? Mm-hmm. So in each member, so in the causal series, so for me to begin to exist, because I don't always exist, right? Mm-hmm. It's just like the train cars, they are not always moving. They begin to move. So I don't always exist. I begin to exist. And for me to begin to exist, my parents have to begin to exist first, right? And so to have analogy that's analogous to that, right, we have to think about a train car that begins to move rather than a train car that is always moving, right? To say that a train car is always moving seems to be assuming that I always exist, which is not the case. Yeah.
Sure. Okay. I think I see more clearly now what's going on here, maybe where the difference comes in. So there's this helpful distinction in the philosophy of time, which we could spend ages on, of course, as well. Mm-hmm. But maybe very briefly just describe this. You can characterize the same sequence of events in two ways, either in a dynamic way or in a static way. Right. So you can say something like, my trip to the dentist is future, right? And then you wait and then you say my trip to the dentist is present. And then later on you say my trip to the dentist is past or something. Right? So you have this dynamic way of describing things. But then you can describe exactly the same description, the same event, say that in a different way, because you can say something like, my consoling myself about my sore tooth is before my trip to the dentist. It's earlier than the trip to the dentist. And my feeling a lot better after having my tooth taken out is after later than the trip to the dentist, right? And the first set of facts changes as time passes, but the second set of facts doesn't change as time passes, right? And I guess I'm thinking about the sequence of causal events in the second way, right? So I'm saying, okay, I begin to exist at, say, t0. That's true. I don't exist at time earlier than t0. But on the other hand, I just want to say, from that static point of view, earlier than my beginning to exist, there's a cause. And earlier than that, there's a cause for whatever caused me to begin to exist. And indeed, later than me, there'll be an effect that I have where I bring something into existence, right? And then after that, that will... So I'm just describing all of the sequence of causal events in a timeless perspective, right, in that kind of static way, which seems equally valid. And so I don't see any reason why I can't talk about it like that. And then if I do, I now fail to see why, all of those facts about the beginning and the ending, they just seem like they're all timelessly true, if you like, about what happens at particular times, right? Like I begin to exist at t0. That statement is true regardless of when I say it. So now I feel like there's that. So I think the difference is that you want to talk about it in a dynamic way, whereas I think I'm talking about it in a kind of static way. And that might be where our disagreement comes in.
I should just warn you, I think I'm tracking with this, but you may have slightly lost me. And that means you may have lost some of the audience. But let's keep going. And if you want to just maybe restate again, Alex's position there, just for my benefit as much as anyone else's. Andrew.
Yeah. So Alex thinks that my argument is based on a dynamic view of time,
okay, right?
Whereas he's assuming a static view of time.
And right? And just again, the difference being that a dynamic view sees things as past, present, and future, mm-hmm. and a static view is more just to get. I'm not sure I quite grasp the difference between the static. Do you want to try again, there, Alex? Sorry.
And later than.
So earlier than and later than. And how is that different to past and future?
Well, because so take for instance World War One and World War Two, right? Mm-hmm. World War One is earlier than World War Two, and World War Two is later than World War One, right? But that fact about their relation being earlier and later than each other is independent of whenever I'm speaking. It doesn't make any difference if my current.
I see. So from where you're from your position, they're both in the past, but
right, and yes, and that changes because I mean I wasn't ever in the future for me, but you know, presumably for some people it was in the future and then they experienced it and then it was in the past, whereas the relational fact about which one's earlier and which one's later doesn't change,
right? Okay,
it doesn't change as time passes. It's just a statement about what's related in time,
and that's the static view, and you're saying you're thinking of it in the static way, Andrew's thinking of it in the dynamic way, and this is where we're having a difference of opinion on how you conceive this endless chain of potential causes and effect. Okay.
Yeah, so let me respond to that. Yes. Yeah, so okay. I want to clarify by saying that my argument doesn't depend on the dynamic view of time. Even on the static view, it is still the case that later events are in a way dependent on earlier events. So for mm-hmm. example, if hydrogen isn't formed in the earlier history of the universe, right? Later on, there won't be water, right? So the existence of water on Earth is requires that the hydrogen is formed at the early history of the Earth, right? So and that is true, regardless of whether the dynamic view or static view is true. Yeah. So my argument is not based on a particular view of time, but it's based on the notion of dependence, right? That later events are in a way dependent on earlier events. For later events to begin to exist, earlier events have to begin to exist first, and that is the problem.
And that gives you your infinite regress, which in your view has to be terminated in a first cause. I mean, I don't want to maybe do we want to kind of accept that obviously I'm not going to get you guys to agree on this in this section
maybe
of the program.
Maybe it might be that there's just a difference in perspective. It might just be me being thick as well. Let's remember that.
No, I'm sure it's not that. I'm sure it's that you guys obviously thinking about this in different directions. Before we go to a final break, where does this take us? If we were to again try and just move it on a bit, do you have any fundamental problems, Alex, with if you were to be convinced that there's a sort of first cause is necessary, that you have to have someone giving the money or starting the train off or whatever. And in the case of our existence, there has to be a first cause starting that cause would look something like God, or do you contest that kind of an outcome from this?
Yeah, that bit I also find very confusing. So
I predicted you would somehow, but yeah.
Well, I'm happy to talk about, let's put that to one side, and let's just say for the sake of argument that we had established definitely that it was a first cause, and then we can talk about what the problems are with that.
Well, why don't we do that, and we'll give ourselves a little time now. We'll go to our break slightly early, and we'll come back for a good amount of time to flesh this one out, because I think that's an important thing to also talk about on the show today. Is God the cause of the universe, we're asking? It may have sounded at times like we were having a financial program today with all this talk of lending money and who's going to pay the bill at the end of the day. But no, this is a philosophical debate on Unbelievable today. And appreciate you being with us for this. Andrew Loke, Assistant Professor of Philosophy and Religion at Hong Kong Baptist University, is making the case for God as the best explanation of how things came into being in the very first place, and Alex Malpass, our atheist philosopher, is doing his job trying to make the case against. So we'll continue this discussion in a short moment's time here on the show that aims to get you thinking very hard this week, Unbelievable. Hi, it's Justin again. Occasionally, listeners get in touch to say, I love what you're doing with the show. We need to have more of these conversations. Can I help? Well, the answer is yes. Creating these kinds of conversations obviously takes time and money, and we're producing more and more video, audio, and online content from Unbelievable. So if you'd like to support this work and contribute any amount, go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and click on Give. And as a thank you, you'll receive my brand new ebook, In Conversation With, featuring some of my favourite chats with people like Jordan Peterson, Tim Keller, Richard Dawkins, Paula Gooder, Darren Brown, and Rick Warren. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and click on Give. Thanks for listening and supporting the show. Welcome back to the third and final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. And today's programme available over at the YouTube channel as well, in video format. You can also find links to the social media, the app, the newsletter, the big conversation, the DVD download of this year's Unbelievable conference, ways to give as well from Unbelievable's webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Plans are afoot as well for a big overhaul of the Unbelievable website to make it a more accessible, attractive kind of a place to go and get all your resources from Unbelievable. We've been gradually piecemeal over the years, adding more and more, bolting on more and more to Unbelievable, and we'd like to give it a nice cohesive look in the latter part of this year. So we'll have a nice new website, hopefully before the end of the year, to unveil for you. Going to be bringing some of your feedback to some shows from the past few weeks a little bit later on. If you can come back for next week's edition of the programme, I'll be playing out some highlights from this year's London conference, Unbelievable the Conference 2019, Speaking Truth in a Post-Truth World. Had so much great feedback from that. We slightly rejigged the format as well to allow more plenary sessions at the beginning of the conference. That went down very well. Loads of great speakers, lots of great engagement across all the seminars, and we'll be bringing you some highlights on next week's show and reminding you that you can pre-order the DVD and digital download of this year's conference, where we had people like Krish Kandaya, Christy Mayer, Bruxy Cavey, Craig Hazen, Paul Spears, Fred Sanders, Lorcan Price, Lawrence Wilkinson, Ryan Christopher, who else? Sarah Lumger, and of course the team from Premier Youth and Children's Work, Ruth Jackson and Emily Howarth, along with Tim Olford, who was brilliant as well. I hadn't really met Tim before the conference, but he just led some amazing seminars. Loads of great feedback to that. So we'll be picking a few bits and pieces, but as I say, if you want to see, watch, hear the whole thing in full, go to our website where you can now pre-order the DVD and the digital download, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Before we return to the final part of today's deep dive philosophical discussion, I fancy myself a bit of Jimmy. Yes, that classic Woodstock Star-Spangled Banner solo 50 years ago, believe it or not. It would have been, wouldn't it, summer of 69 that Jimi Hendrix played Woodstock. But the Star-Spangled Banner, because we're coming out to the USA this October. No, we're not going to have Jimi Hendrix, but we're going to have some stars in their own rights. John Lennox, Dave Rubin going to be joining me for the big conversation at Calvary Chapel Costa Mesa on Friday, the 11th of October. And John Lennox stays on for Unbelievable the Conference LA, along with some other brilliant speakers. Brian Broderson, senior pastor of Calvary Chapel Costa Mesa, who's led churches both in the UK and the USA, will be one of our speakers. Another church leader who's become a firm friend of the show as well will be joining us, Jeff Vines, pastor. Christ Church of the Valley in San Dimas, and he's got a background in international mission church planting, has led churches in Africa, New Zealand and California, and the author of a really great book, Dinner with Skeptics, Defending God in a World That Makes No Sense. Plus we've got some great apologetics ministries joining us, Sean McDowell, J. Warner Wallace, the former atheist with a background as a homicide detective who's gone on to develop Cold Case Christianity, Anjanette Roberts, AJ as she is known, from Reasons to Believe, putting science and faith together. Mary Jo Sharp, assistant professor of apologetics out at HBU. Former atheist herself, she now runs Confident Christianity. And Ruth Jackson is going to be joining me from Premier here in the UK. She is editor of Premier Youth and Children's Work magazine, who do all kinds of resourcing of youth ministry. And Ruth's own passion is also apologetics. And she's going to be bringing us the youth dynamic as well. And of course, we'll all be sitting under the wisdom of John Lennox, who's going to be with us there for the day. It's an unmissable event. Do get yourself booked in. Bring friends. Tell others about it. And the website to book your place is simply unbelievable.live. Thank you very much, Jimmy. Time to get into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So in the final part of today's discussion, big philosophical discussion on whether God is the cause of the universe, we've been hearing from Andrew Loke from Hong Kong Baptist University and Alex Malpass, atheist philosopher. Again, do make sure to check out the links from today's show to both of their works. God and Ultimate Origins is the big book from Andrew, arguing the philosophical case for God as the cause of the universe. And Alex runs the Use of Reason website and the Thoughtology podcast, which you might want to check out as well. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable for today's show and the links there. And just in that last section, I think we decided by consensus that we'd maybe agree to disagree on this idea of whether, you know, it's necessarily wrong to talk of an infinite series of causes and effects. And say, well, let's say we are agreed, maybe we need a first cause. Okay, let's move to that part of the argument. And in your view, that first cause would be, God would be the best explanation of this first cause. Do you want to just spell it out briefly again, and then we'll get Alex to respond, Andrew?
Yeah, so earlier on I explained that infinite regress of causes is not possible, and that I also explained that my argument is not dependent on a dynamic or a static view of time. That regardless, no matter what view of time is true, the dependence relation, right, will still requires a first cause that's independent, right, anything else. And so this independent first cause must be uncaused, obviously, right, because it's the first, right. Mm-hmm. It can exist independently, and in order for it to exist independently, it must also be without beginning, because everything that begins to exist requires a cause. And I defend this key premise in chapter 5 of my book, right, where I give a deductive argument to prove that everything that begins to exist has a cause. We have time to discuss this. And Justin, you said we are short of time.
We'll leave that one.
For anyone who is interested to find out, they can check out my book, chapter 5 of my book. Given that that is the case, the first cause must be without beginning. And the first cause must also be initially changeless, because an infinite regress of changes is not possible. I define a change as an event that is something that has beginning of existence. You can't have infinite regress of that. And therefore, there must be... And also, the first event, right, must have... can begin to exist uncaused as well, on the basis of the causal principle, right? And so the first event must have been brought about, right, by a first cause which is initially changeless. And for the initially changeless first cause to cause the first event to change and cause the first event, the first cause must have the capacity to initiate the first event, and also have the capacity to prevent itself from changing initially, right? So such that it can be initially changeless. And so the first cause must have this dual capacity, right, to initiate the first event and also to be able to prevent itself from initiating the first event. Mm-hmm. And this two...
The capacity to choose, essentially.
To just freely start things off, mm-hmm. right? And this characterizes free will. Mm-hmm. And so the first cause must have free will. And finally, the first cause must also have tremendous power, right, to bring about this entire universe. And actually, at this juncture, one might also bring in, considerations based on fine-tuning, for example, but that would take us another way. Right? Mm. That would also argue that this first cause must be highly intelligent as well, right, in order to bring about a universe that is highly ordered and fine-tuned. Right?
Capabilities and things to this first cause. But in the end, even just with the idea of this first cause having free will and enormous power, you're already looking at something that looks like the classical view of God.
A creator.
Essentially, of a creator God. So basically, Alex, checkmate atheist. There you go. Not really. I know that there's lots you want to say about how we got here, but let's go with this first cause idea. What's your view? Would this first cause have to look like a God, a creator God, in the way that Andrew has spelled out here?
Yeah, so I'm not convinced, obviously, no surprise, right? I've been trying to think about the clearest way of stating it. So to me, right, there's something kind of difficult to grasp about the notion of a... let's be clear about it. The first cause is being posited as a personal being, right, who has... free will, libertarian free will, and makes a decision, chooses to cause the world to come into existence. So it's not a mechanism that's forced to do it because the cogs were turning and it just did it eventually or something. It's an agent making free choice. Now, I am dubious here as as to the legitimacy of that concept once we've deviated so far away from our ordinary experience of agents. So for instance, I've obviously never experienced any agents that weren't located in time, right? I'm certainly not located in space as well. And I'm not completely convinced that it makes sense to say that you could decide, make a choice based on a reason, unless you were already in time. I'm not sure what that can really mean. I'm happy to go into more detail about that, but it does strike me as a very...
And the very same thought struck me as well, that can you even speak of choosing something if the concept of time hasn't yet kind of been created, you know, because it does appear that when I choose something, there's a passage of time and a sequence of events, if you like.
And if I could just develop the thought a very tiny bit further so that it's not just simply me saying, well, that's weird, because I objected a minute ago to saying, you know, everything that's weird is false, right? But so I do think, just want to just start that off by saying it is weird, and I'm not quite sure whether it makes sense to say that there's an agent that can make choices that doesn't exist in time. But I also want to point out that it feels to me like there's a kind of a move which strikes me as at least worth bringing up, right? So there's a point in Andrew's book where he refers to an objection by Quentin Smith. I'm going to very briefly read this out. So Smith contends that there's no standard theory of causation according to which an agent could have caused the universe to exist. Right? So he's saying, what does it mean to say an agent caused the universe to exist? And then you quote Craig, who's saying, in reply to Smith, Craig observes that the definitions discussed by Smith are exclusively concerned with natural physical causes, and they're not intended to cover such recondite cases as divine causation of the origin of the universe. One must be careful not to beg the question against a divine cause by defining causality in such a way that the definition expresses a prejudice against the possibility of divine cause. Right? So what I take that to mean is if Smith saying, look, take causation from like physics or whatever, and there's no special bit in that that like got agents doing stuff, right? All agent causes, as described by physics, are just normal types of physical causation, right? There's no additional type of causation. So agent causation is already a type of causation that doesn't fit into our best physical understanding of what causation is. And Craig's saying, yeah, but you shouldn't expect our best physical description of causation to be the one that's relevant here, because we're talking about the beginning of the universe, so it's going to be different from our normal experience of things. And I think, okay, that's fair enough, right? It is possible, of course, that there's a different type of causation that's at play here. But I just want to note that if the move is to abandon the normal type of causation at that point and to say that it's not, we should expect it to not be the type of causation that we see in everyday life, then the inference from all of those things we say, everything that begins to exist around me has a cause, well, that's a different type of cause, right? So it already makes me think that, you know, we've shifted away from the good inductive basis that we had there. And now we're talking about agents making choices. But of course, it's not an agent like one we know about, right? Because all the ones we know about are in time.
Located in time and space.
It's completely different to that, right? So,
So does this amount to kind of a sort of special pleading for God by, you know, that we're okay, if there's a problem talking about causation in time and space, we're just going to say, well, it's something different here. And
it feels to me like if the door has been opened to start talking about things that are completely different to anything we've experienced before, then there are other options out there. So for instance, there's this nice paper by Alexander Vilenkin from 1987, I think, where he talks, it's a four-page paper, it's mainly equations, but a basic picture of it is that the universe tunneled into existence from nothing, right? Crazy idea, but it's quite cool. But basically what he has to have there is that there are laws of physics pre-existing, the universe coming into being, and that they somehow have a causal input into that tunneling event. But, you know, someone might want to say laws of physics, they don't cause stuff, right? They're like abstract objects that don't cause anything. But to quote Andrew, one must be careful not to beg the question against a theory of laws of nature causing stuff, right? Even though we've no experience of that happening before, maybe that's just what happened. You know, we shouldn't be prejudiced against the possibility. So I feel like once we've opened the doors there, you're limitless
right.
human and, imagination and to pick up anything. Right?
Yeah, it feels like we've approached, you know, I did a show with that was more in the scientific realm with Sean Carroll and Luke Barnes a while ago, where they basically got down to the point about brute facts. Are you going to just have a brute fact that reality exists, or that God is the brute fact behind reality, and so on? And it feels a bit like, you know, well,
I'm just going to choose my special cause and you'll choose your special cause and we'll, we'll both agree to. So where do we go with this, Andrew? How do you reconcile this idea that you know, are you begging the question by saying, well, we're talking about a different kind of cause when it comes to an agent like God who exists outside of time and space, whereas all the other causes we know about, you know, exist within that particular kind of framework?
Yeah, so let me clarify by first saying that my conclusion that there must be a first cause with free will is arrived at deductively, right? So I deduce, right, that it must have the capacity to initiate the first event, right, in a way that is not determined by prior events and also have the capacity to prevent itself from changing. Now, Alex is concerned that in our ordinary experiences, we have no experience of such a thing. Mm. But my response is that, well, you know, there are things that we can know without having to experience ourselves. So, for example, I can know that there is no such things as a shapeless square, for example, right? Because it violates the laws of logic, right? Mm-hmm. And so I don't have to experience the whole universe. I don't have to check every part of the universe to make sure, oh, you know, there's no shapeless square here, there's no shapeless square there, in order to know that there can't be such a thing, right? Mm-hmm. I just have to understand it. I just have to understand what a shape means and mm-hmm. what a square means, and then I'll be able to deduce that there cannot be such a thing as a shapeless square, mm-hmm. right? So likewise, I don't have to experience the first cause myself or know that, oh, you know, it has free will, but I can arrive at it by laws of logic, by deduction, and by have a clear sense of the
So you get to the first cause by this deductive process.
Yeah, that's right, by understanding, actually.
Yeah, and then what about the actual agency, though? I think that's the thing that Alex objects to.
So let me move on, So that's my first point of response. My second point of response is to say that, in fact, agent causation is not all that unfamiliar to us. In fact, our basic notion of causation is primarily agent causation. So, for example, for me, it seems to me that I can choose to come here this morning, and I can choose not to come here this morning. So agent causation is, in fact, something very familiar to us. Now, there'll be people who say that, well, no, that's just an illusion, right? Agent causation is an illusion, and everything can be explained by the deterministic law of physics, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's where Quentin Smith is coming from. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but... but regardless of whether that is true or not, right, this notion itself is intelligible, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Whether it can be explained by causal determinism, that is another question. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is that this notion is familiar to us, is intelligible, and the first cause must have this in order to bring about the first event, right? Okay. And the reason why the first cause must have this is it follows from the premises of my argument. Right.
Right. So the first cause must have this capacity for agent causation.
Yes.
Just in order for there to be something that begins everything and gets us here. And Alex, though, I think is saying, but the only way we understand agent causation is in terms of time and space and things following sequentially in events. And you're talking about something that seems to exist outside of that reality, beyond that reality. So at that point, you know, who knows what we could posit.
Okay, this brings me to the third point of response, right? Mm. So I don't think there's anything essential to the definition of agent causation that requires it to be always in time. I don't think there's anything essential to the definition. I think it's just an accidental property, that we in our world, we happen to we are in time, and therefore we understand ourselves to be acting in time. But I don't think it's essential to the definition itself that requires it that it must be in time, right? That's on the one hand. On the other hand, again, I say, what follows deductively from the premises is that there must be such a first cause, right? Has this ability to bring about other things, and in order for it to start the first event, it must have this free will. And let me just add also that I don't think the notion of deliberation is necessary for agents as well. So just now, Justin, I think you mentioned that for us, right, making a decision takes time, right? And we need to deliberate, right, before we decide, right? But the notion of deliberation is not essential to libertarian free choice. In fact, if a divine first cause exists, if God is omniscient, for example, he wouldn't need to deliberate, right? Oh, should I create Alex or should I not create Alex? He doesn't need to deliberate, right? He will have known from eternity. Mm. And so if such a divine first cause exists, we wouldn't need deliberation. And I have already shown by my argument that there must be such a first cause. Yeah.
We are going to have to start wrapping this up, I'm afraid. And that's a shame because there's so many more things that we could uncover here, I'm sure, Alex.
Can I jump
with that in mind?
Jump
in, quick response, and then I'll ask you to start sort of concluding, gentlemen. Sorry,
okay.
Like all these things, you know, I can't have an infinite chain of arguments on my program, and that's just the reality. For carry
which on. Would be the only way of settling this.
Absolutely.
So. But okay, so it does feel to me like, I guess you can have libertarian free choice without deliberation, right? So, but it does. I can pick things at random, I guess, if I have libertarian choice. But if I'm doing things for reasons, but there's no process of deliberation first, I then start to wonder why it's different from a random choice. You know, and it's all. So you can say maybe God considers the reasons for doing the action simultaneously with doing the action. That feels to me very much like, I mean, so if you take any other case of somebody doing something, not thinking about why they're doing it first, but thinking about it whilst they're doing it. Well, certainly take someone who says, well, I chose to have coffee instead of tea, but I'm going to make my mind up about why I did that after I make that choice. You'd say that was nonsense, right? It's too late to make your mind up about it, right? If you had reasons for it, they have to be before the event. I mean, maybe they can be simultaneous with, but I think that what you've got there, if someone's considering the actions as they're doing it, I think that's basically indistinguishable from somebody doing something for no reason. I'm not sure that there's, I think that's a distinction without a difference. So I think that in that case, I'd be questioning whether or not you end up with a theology where God just makes the world randomly. And then I kind of think, well, what's the difference in that and just saying it happened for no reason? So I think, you know, you have to have a process of deliberation in the first place in order for it to fit into the idea of it being done for a reason. Right, and I think that's crucial to the account.
Yeah, quick response, Andrew, and then we'll
okay,
do final,
so,
final thoughts.
Yeah, for finite human minds, you know, for us to make decisions, we need time to do it. But for infinite mind, you know, God has reasons, but God doesn't have to require time in order to make up his mind to think through these things. He can have all these reasons in eternity. And so my view of God is that God exists beginninglessly, timelessly and changelessly without the first event. And in that state, you know, God is already aware of all the reasons. He doesn't need time to think about them. And then he freely chooses to undertake, right, to bring about the first event. And that's with a reason, yeah, with reason to do so.
We will leave it there. And I fully understand you would disagree and have further questions on that, Alex. Final thoughts from you, Alex, as we close out today's show. And thank you so much for being such a willing participant and keeping things at a level where I was able to follow as well. Yeah, go ahead.
All right, yeah, well, thanks very much for having me. It's been an enjoyable conversation. And I guess I want to say that I think a lot of these arguments, while they look ironclad and deductive on paper, they often end up requiring a kind of intangible... like gestalt shift between perspectives, right? So like the duck rabbit thing where you can see it in two different directions, as a duck or as a rabbit, and you just sort of adopt a way of looking at a perspective or something and things seem different. So for instance, with the notion of the traversing the infinite, I totally understand, you know, it does feel like, you know, if the moving now had to traverse an infinite number of previous moments, it would never arrive here. That does feel completely, you know, convincing to me. I totally understand that. But then I have an injury. I then shift from looking at it as a duck to looking at it as a rabbit, and I think, well, if it had been doing it for an infinite amount of time already, that would have been enough time for it to get here. And that seems perfectly ironclad as an intuition. So they both kind of dissolve on contact with each other, and I'm left wondering, well, I just don't know. So that's where I feel with these things, is that we can only go so far before. I think my perspective, and there are people who are much cleverer than me, but my perspective is at a certain point my brain is unable to clasp onto anything with enough solidity to form a concrete opinion about it.
That's sometimes the way I feel at the end of a philosophical discussion, and unbelievable as well. But
that's how I feel at the end of every philosophical discussion I've ever had about anything.
Final thought, Andrew, as we close out the show.
Well, what I want to say is that, yes, our minds are finite, but we do have the ability to know certain truths, so for example, the truth of logic, for example. And on the basis of this truth, we can deduce that a divine first cause exists. And I would also want to say that, you know, in order for us to... we need to have a better... And so the solution to the issues that Alex raises is actually to have a better understanding of of the issues of what causality means, or what the causal principle means, what libertarian theory means. And once we get these notions clear, I think the conclusions follows, and the conclusion will be undeniable, actually, in that sense.
You really see this as a really strong, to use Alex's phrase, ironclad argument in that sense for God. You think it's pretty unavoidable if you follow the evidence as far as you're concerned.
Yeah, it's just like I can know that there can't be anything like a shapeless square, I mentioned just now, right? Once we understand what shape means and what square means, right, we can come to that conclusion. And likewise, when we understand the relevant notions for the cosmological argument, I think we will come to the conclusion that a divine first cause must exist as well.
And well, look,
Final as well. So for me, this divine first cause, right, it's not just some kind of abstract philosophical notion, right? Rather, it's something, something concrete, something that brings about the entire universe. And also, it's a divine person, right, whom I can know personally as well, right? So I can have this relationship with him, right, through Jesus Christ. And and to experience this divine first cause, right, is really the greatest blessing in the whole entire universe, right? To know the source of all joy and goodness and blessing, you know, that's the most wonderful thing in the whole universe. And it's my prayer and hope that and Alex, you know, and all the listeners, you know, can experience this.
Yeah, of course, because for you this is far more than just a analytical philosophical argument. In the end, it's the source of
existential significance.
Appreciate you saying that, and thank you very much for being on the show today, Andrew. Alex, thanks for being with us today as well. It's been great to have you both on. Do make sure to check out the websites of both my guests today. Make sure there are links from today's show, and look forward to hearing your thoughts as well as feedback to today's program. But for the moment, Andrew and Alex, all the very best, and see you next time.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Justin.
Thank you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Email is always a good way to get in touch with the show. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. It's facebook.com/unbelievablejb for the Facebook page. And @unbelievablejb is the Twitter handle. Let's go to a couple of ones that I've been saving up. We did a few weeks ago now, the transhumanism debate. That was so fascinating. I was joined by Micah Redding, founder of the Christian Transhumanist Association, and the more sceptical voice on the programme about this whole transhumanist idea was Nigel Cameron. And transhumanism being this idea that, you know, we may one day transcend the limitations of our human body through science and technology. And we're asking, should Christians embrace that? Derek wanted to say this. I heard the difference in that show between the evangelist and the theologian. Mr. Cameron, in the role of worldview police, and Mr. Redding as evangelist, I'm thoroughly convinced that if given the opportunity, many theologians would have zealously counseled the Apostle Paul away from using any reference to the unknown God or pagan poetry in his appeal to the Athenians, as he did in Acts 17. I do sympathise, though, with Mr. Cameron, because I myself wouldn't label myself trans anything, but I'm also not called to this niche group of people. I'm not sure that Mr. Cameron is either, which is apparent in him calling the people of this group gullible. By way of illustration, let's say you have a group of people who hop on one foot from place to place. Of course, the philosopher will write endlessly on the pros and cons of hopping on one foot. At the end of the day, though, if someone desires to reach this group for Christ, they're going to have to get in there and hop on one foot, in addition to calling him or herself a one-foot hopper. Mr. Redding is merely hopping on one foot for the gospel. Incidentally, while I can't imagine teenage gamers reading Mr. Cameron's writing, I can easily picture them scanning through Mr. Redding's website. The worldview police simply cannot take away our liberty in Christ, on which Paul wrote extensively in Romans. Thank you, Derek. You obviously feel that there's something in this transhumanism stuff. This one, though, from Eric, who's a friend of the show out in the US, so coming to Unbelievable in California. You say, you've put together an outstanding lineup. Look forward to the conference and hopefully meeting you in person. It was a fascinating show on transhumanism. As a neonatologist caring for sick newborns, the discussion about the use of technology for human betterment struck a nerve in me. I've seen many technologies, drugs, and treatment strategies come and go. I've seen innovations that have increased survival, but also many that have caused harm. Science has done many great things, but must be implemented very carefully because, despite all of our acquired knowledge, we still know so little. I fear that the excitement over transhumanism, just like transgenderism, will lead us down pathways that may cause more medical harm than good. In the practice of medicine, it's important to recognise the natural history of a disease. We need to understand the normal response of the body so that we can can assess whether or not we should intervene, when we should intervene, or how we should intervene. Sadly, many times medical theories based on flawed or incomplete science have caused us to act inappropriately, and patients have ended up suffering. Humans are notoriously famous for jumping the scientific gun without completely understanding the race they're actually running. I think we need to be very cautious about trying to make humans better in the future when we're barely able to keep them properly functioning in the present. We need to concentrate on restoring humans before we start accessorizing them. If we can't even cure brain cancer, then I don't think we should waste our resources trying to upload our brains to the cloud. The discussion about the theological implications of transhumanism raised many questions that I hadn't thought about before. As image bearers, I believe we're called to be both healers and creators. However, as Clint Eastwood famously said, a man's got to know his limitations. Since Jesus is the ultimate image bearer, we need to look to him as our example. Jesus did a great deal of healing, but it was more about restoring shriveled hands than creating bionic arms. Unfortunately, with the fall, we bit off a bit more forbidden fruit than we could chew and began to be like God instead of settling for his very good. We've tried to help him out by transforming it into the very, very good, which is a problem for creatures who lack divine creation credentials. Instead of rethinking God's thoughts by admiring the creational words he spoke into existence, we divinize our own and ended up creatively speaking man into our own image. We appropriately hear creation groan, but instead of calling in a soul surgeon, we practice cosmetic surgery without a license. Loving all these metaphors, Eric, in your email here. You finish off by saying, I appreciate the attitude of the Christian transhumanist who wants to bring a Christian voice to the movement. While we might have a seat at the theoretic table, I suspect that we will be barred from the laboratory. We can kick the ethical tires of transhumanism, but that won't stop science from taking it for a test drive. I hope I'm wrong, but my experience in medicine and science has shown that what drives technology is greed, pride, and notoriety, not ethics. The original sin of being like God elevates science to the divine right of a king. Therefore, I suspect that transhumanism will proceed full speed ahead. Damn the ethical torpedoes. While we may not be able to stop the flood, we can at least be there to throw Jesus life preservers to those who are drowning. Thanks again for another great show. Thank you, Eric. Glad you enjoyed that. Go back in the archives about 4 weeks to find our show on transhumanism. You can find it from the show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Many people, of course, download it every week via their favourite podcasting software. And I'm really glad to say that we'll be coming live to many of the people who enjoy this show in North America. Do make sure to get yourself booked in for Unbelievable live in LA on Friday the 11th and Saturday the 12th of October. The website is unbelievable.com. Live. Beck Hill is here next, a comedian with a speciality in paper puppetry, believe it or not. She'll be talking about her life and faith with Megan Cornwell on The Profile next. For now, let me tell you what's coming up on next week's edition of Unbelievable. You're unbelievable. What a great week we had in London just about a month ago now, as we had Unbelievable, the conference 2019. Hundreds of people joined us for a whole day looking at the theme of speaking truth in a post-truth world. We're going to bring you a few highlights from it on next week's programme, so look out for that on your radio set and in your podcast feed. And do get the whole thing on DVD or digital download. You can pre-order it now from the Unbelievable website. For now, thanks for being with me, and we'll see you next time. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.